Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Above Politics Show. I'm Homer Fife.
And I'm Martin Bain, and we have a lot to catch up on that's been happening in the world of politics.
Yeah, how's your health care?
Ah, well, in the United Kingdom, we really have a great health care system. You know, I get it from birth, it's there until I die, I pay some taxes, and then when I need to go to the hospital, I need an operation, I need some work, I can get it on the NHS, or if I so desire, I want to get away from the waiting lists or have it done slightly more quickly, I just pay a bit of money to an insurance company. It's great.
Well, now here's the thing, Martin. We have a great health care, too, you know, because people that are too poor to afford actual insurance can go to the hospital. They can get done whatever they want to get done for free. Now, they can't get elective surgeries done. You can't go there and have a Michael Jackson nose inserted in your face, but if you have an emergency or you have a pain or you have anything that you need fixed, you can go to a hospital currently. And look, my wife works at a hospital, and I know this for a fact. And you know what? Here's my biggest problem I have with this health care trying to be pushed down our throats by President Obama. I have two problems with it. First and foremost is the fact that if you want good health care here in the United States, all you have to do is get a job and work for it. Every single major employer that I know offers health benefits after you've been with them for a while. Now, they're not going to give that to the person they hire off the streets tomorrow simply because they don't know if they'll be working for them the next day. So these people complaining about not having health care, the poor and underprivileged, you know, go get a job. Get a job that offers good insurance, number one. Number two, you know, Obama's trying to run this thing, what is it, $1.2 trillion bill down our throat at a time when the job rate is well into the double digits all across this nation. The state of South Carolina, where I am, Martin, has a 14% unemployment rate right now, 14%. And, you know, Obama, and he's actually been caught any number of times. Rush Limbaugh has come right out with the facts and figures where his numbers of people that don't have health care, well, they're including people that are covered by their parents. They're including people that have specifically said they don't want health care. They're including the Medicaid, the people on Medicaid right now. So, you know, there's something fishy going on here, buddy.
No, I don't doubt. I mean, it is always interesting to sort of look around the world and compare the healthcare systems. I mean, we have an absolute free at point of delivery for the vast majority of treatments that I and anybody else in the UK would need. Certainly, at some surgeries like you spoke about, having a Michael Jackson nose, for example, that could be paid for on the National Health Service only if that was deemed that was an appropriate thing to do and would change something about your life or change significantly about the way you feel about yourself. But certainly in the UK, the vast majority of cosmetic surgeries, unless they're, you know, for serious medical reasons, are not covered. Our health service is about, you know, if you need treatment, you get treatment. It's not about, you know, the things that, you know, typically the vanity things.
Right. Martin, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to this, though, that people aren't taking into consideration. Number one, let's take a look at let's just discuss for a minute what's going to happen if and when this healthcare thing comes in. First thing it's going to do is it's going to put several of the insurance companies, if not all of them, completely out of business. Blue Cross and Blue Shield have come right out with a statement to the public stating that they cannot survive Obama's health care bill. Because what's going to happen is everybody's going to opt for that instead of staying under the Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And how many people is that going to put out of work? I mean, I don't know, but I will guarantee you it's thousands of people work for Blue Cross and Blue Shield. They're huge. In fact, that's what my insurance is. Most of Blue Cross and Blue Shield does most of the state insurance for people that are state employees.
But a lot of it is in the UK, you have the NHS as a fallback, but there are a great many people who pay private medical insurance so that they don't necessarily have to wait. They can go and see someone quickly, and if they do have to go in for any kind of surgery, they can get to go into a private hospital. Now,
but now, Martin, see, that's the problem with our bill. Obama's not going to allow that. See, under the bill, you will be forced to take the government-sponsored insurance. See, that's the problem, you know, because, I mean, now they're not going to say, if you don't take it, we're going to arrest you. No, not by any means. But what they're doing is the government-sponsored health care is going to be so cheap and so undercut the prices that are currently, you know, like with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. All right, let's just say, for instance, just as an example, let's say they charge my company, and just to use a figure, let's say they charge my company $100,000 a year in order to provide insurance to all our employees, right? Okay. Obama's going to come out with the health care that's only going to charge the company $50,000. So it's going to be so ridiculously undercut that Blue Cross and Blue Shield's just not going to be able to stay in business. And in your situation, it's totally different because you've had that government-sponsored health care since, I don't know, since, I guess, forever.
Since, I think it's 1947, although I will stand to be corrected. But yes,
well, let's just say in that general area. And that's fine, but now all of a sudden here in 2009, you know, health care is a big issue and it's expensive, yeah, and it is. And I'm not going to say it's not. But now all of a sudden, we're having this rammed down our throat, and many, many, many businesses are going to suffer from it. And I'm not saying a good health care program for the poor isn't a good idea, but to make it a universal health care program for everyone in the United States is a mistake.
Because it is interesting that you talk very much about the word insurance, whereas in the UK, it's not regarded as an insurance. It's something that is just provided for us out of the general taxes. So, you know, we don't have to pay, my company doesn't pay anything extra. This is just something that, you know, a percentage of my taxes goes to the NHS. So, and I suppose that's one of the issues is, you know, how does a sophisticated country go from not having a socialized healthcare system to having a socialized healthcare system? And I just wonder whether Barack Obama is actually planning to deliver a socialized healthcare system. I don't think he is. What I think he's trying to do is use the government to act as the insurance broker to take the money to then go out to private hospitals to then get them to say, right, you know, you come and sign up with the government and we'll guarantee you a certain amount of work from your area, you know, at an agreed rate to say, right, if you do this surgery for us as the government, we'll pay you a certain amount of dollars. Whereas in the UK, yes, there is a budget and there's always pressures on it, but, you know, it's not an insurance. I can go to any hospital anywhere in the United Kingdom. I'm not limited by the state, by any insurance. If I happen to be on holiday in Scotland and I hurt myself, I can just go to the nearest hospital. If I'm, you know, working in London, I can just go to the nearest hospital. I don't have to be thinking, is this hospital got an insurance agreement and all this type of thing?
Well, now that's one of the other problems, isn't it? The fact that Obama's bill to introduce this is several thousand pages long. And by all accounts, no one has completely read it except for the people that wrote it. So, you know, the whole mystery revolves around the fact that, one, why does he want to do this at a time where our economy cannot support it? Martin, he's spending trillions and trillions of dollars for all kinds of BS that may be necessary and may be wanted and may be desired, but again, not right at this time. You know, it's like all of his ecological stuff, you know. There's nothing wrong with wanting to save the ecology. I mean, Lord knows, we need to be better caretakers of this planet. The problem is that he's trying to do it all at once when the economy is not set to support it, when we have an economy with 14% unemployment, and Obama's trying to shove trillions and trillions of dollars down our throat. You know, I mean, what are we supposed to do? We you know, we're going to be pushed out of work.
But in some respects, he'll turn around and say, but I have a mandate from the American people to do this.
Oh, I understand that, and that's what we talked about before. But you know, what kind of mandate are we talking about, Martin? He's going to run this country into the ground before he leaves here.
I mean, you could turn around and say, you know, this could, in this bill could result in a expansion of the medical system in the states and would require potentially many more hospitals and many more medical practitioners, which is, you know, going to increase the net worth of each city, each town, each state.
Martin, that's not going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is because a lot of your hospitals are private over here. They're not all not-for-profit. Now, the hospital my wife works at is a non-profit hospital, but the majority of the hospitals in the United States are for-profit. They're there. They are bought and owned by individuals trying to make money, or by corporations intending to make money. And they're not going to, you know, they're not going to stay open if they can't make money. And they won't be able to make money under Obama's plan. And what about doctors, Martin? How many doctors are there going to be that are going to go into the medical field when Obama's plan cuts their salaries in half?
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, it always begs the question about, you know, whether your primary mechanism for delivering healthcare to your people should be either not for profit or for profit. I mean, I suppose the perspective one comes from in the UK is, well, yes, we have private hospitals, you know, and if you have an insurance policy with some of the major providers, you typically go to a private hospital that is either not for profit or for profit. But the primary method of delivering healthcare to the United Kingdom is in a not for profit mode. The right. NHS is not there to make money. Of course, we expect it to be efficient. We expect it not to waste money. But you know, there's a lot of things. You know, it's like, you know, if you have a baby in the United Kingdom, you don't have to have any insurances. You don't have to pay for anything. All the services related to that one are just there for you.
Yeah, and that's fine, Martin, but your system's been in place for 60-some years, see? And, again, I think most of us that are opposed to this plan, we're not opposed to the plan itself, if I'm making any sense here. We are opposed to the way it's being implemented. We are opposed to the fact that Obama's come out and said 50 million of America's 300 million people are without health insurance, when that's a blatant lie, okay? Yes. Well, all right, let me rephrase that. That's not a lie, okay? It is a misstatement. Because of those 50 million, something like 10 or 15 million are the people that are on Medicaid, so they're getting health care from the government. All right, because Medicaid, what we have over here, Martin, if you're not familiar, we have a system called Medicaid and Medicare. Under Medicare, anyone over the age of 65 gets it's a basic government health insurance. It's basic, based on the same thing that you have over there. A person over the age of 65 can go to the hospital and for little or no money get any treatment they want. They get their prescriptions cheaper, if not free in many times. Well, Medicaid is for people that are under a certain salary. If you fall below the poverty level, you qualify for Medicaid. You go to the government and you get a card, and that card is just like a debit card. And you present it whenever you go to the hospital, you go to the doctor, and your treatments are either free or at a huge discount, of course, depending on your income. So we have a whole system set up. And what most of us are upset about is the attempt of the Obama administration to come in and change all of that overnight at a huge cost to the economy, a huge cost to the job market, a huge cost to some of these mega businesses that have been doing business for decades in this country. And to shove all of this down our throat at a time when the economy is not set up to support it.
But there is a statement to say, you know, if you're going to try and make vast changes, you might as well do it when there's pain. You know, would Obama be looking to do this if the American economy was on the up, it was growing, the unemployment was dropping? Yeah, I can't.
Now that's an interesting thought.
Now I can see the argument for saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, the American economy, just like every other economy around the world, Homer, is suffering. So hang on a minute. Well, what does an extra 5% suffering do? It doesn't. You know, you're in hock for trillions of dollars anyway. Does adding another $1.2 trillion actually make that much difference?
You know what? You know, yeah, you're making a lot of sense there too. And, you know, I guess, and you just kind of give me a little bit of an epiphany here. Obama probably couldn't get this through if the economy was rocking and people were happy, because, you know, you just don't get these world changing policies pushed through at a time where everybody's happy.
And also, you know, you could turn, you know, he may have had people who turn around and I think you're always going to get the dispute of, you know, how many people don't have insurance, and, you know, and it's always interesting to think about the word insurance typically means something that you normally have to pay for yourself and then you claim back. Yeah. So how many people maybe don't take medical treatment, even if they're insured, because, you know, if great, so you've got an insurance policy that says, right, this operation will give you 100% of it back, but if the surgery is going to cost you 10 grand and you haven't got 10 grand to pay for it, how are you going to pay for the 10 grand surgery and then claim it back? Whereas in the UK, I don't have to put any money. If I need a £60,000 operation, I don't have to find £60,000 beforehand or worry or have to think or worry about how am I going to pay the £60,000 before the insurance company does. If I need it and the medical practitioners that I'm consulting with say, I need this operation, it's scheduled. No messing, no arguments.
But Martin, what you're talking about here, as far as putting the money up beforehand, is a fantastic idea. And why didn't some of these people think about instituting something along those lines? A complete reform, and instead of completely changing the healthcare industry here in the United States, why not reform it? Why not make it so that you can have that operation up front without paying for it, and then maybe some way the government could help you pay for it. You know what I'm saying here? You know, there would be a way of reforming it as opposed to completely changing it. See, that's the problem.
Yeah, and I know people have tried to make the parallel between what Barack Obama is trying to do and the system in the UK. And, you know, when people raise this, I have to turn around and say, no, they are totally different. What Barack Obama is talking about is an insurance policy, which is fundamentally different to what I
Correct.
Have in the UK. You know,
Correct.
If you or your wife need surgery, you know, you still typically have to find the money up front, you know, i.e.
Yes.
after, you know, as you're leaving the hospital, someone gives you a bill for $7,900. You still have to potentially pay $7,900
right.
and then go to the insurance company who piss you around. And then, you know, you've got to have $7,900 tied up for 3 months while they wait to pay you the money.
Right. Exactly. Whereas, you know, like you said, this is not a fundamental change towards socialized healthcare like you have. This is nothing more than a cheaper insurance policy that's going to be sponsored by the government. And, you know, again, Martin, that's the problem. And it's being shoved down our throats. And look, all the poor people in the world or in the United States are saying, wow, this is wonderful. I'm going to have insurance. But they're not looking at... You know, when's the last time the United States government took anything and ran it successfully? Can anybody listening to me right now, to the Above Politics show, please tell me any fundamental, anything similar to this that the government has taken and run correctly? Let's look at welfare. Welfare was a program that was instituted by us back in the 1940s and 50s, and there is currently, Martin, 65% fraud in the welfare program. Nothing the government has ever done has ever been successfully run. And I don't know why people are saying, oh, this is a wonderful program, it's going to be fantastic. No, it's not. It's going to be exactly like every other government-run program. It's going to be a bunch of crap, and we're all going to pay for it in the long run, and it's going to ruin this economy.
Yeah, I suspect you will pay for it. I suspect, not entirely sure, you can probably ruin the US economy more than it's potentially ruined, and that's not just a jibe. You know, you only have to look around the other major developed, the first nations of the world, to realize that most of their economies have been well ruined. But and that's something. Guess what, if you want to comment, you know what to do. And but the other interesting thing is I hear that Sarah Palin has almost stepped down from her role of governor in Alaska, and it seems that, you know, of course, being the doyen of the GOP hasn't helped her a lot, but even seems that some people in Alaska are now up in arms that she's sort of leaving before the end of her term.
Yeah, and you know, there's something going on there. Look, I'm a Palin supporter, and I'll gladly say that. But I'm also going to say there's something hinky going on here. You know, she's been under a whole bunch of ethics investigations, and every single one of them so far has brought her out pristine. I mean, she's walked away from it completely clean, never having spent any of the government money or any of the Alaskan people's money, for personal purposes. But here's the thing, Martin. This whole thing screams of, and I hate to use the word prejudice, but, you know, there's not really any other way to look at it. You know, this lady, she has a plain way of talking. She appeals to the average person. She lives and works on a farm. And yet, at the same time, she's a successful politician by all means. I mean, she achieved the governorship of one of the major states in the United States. But it's like that a lot of the liberals are against her because she is plain speaking. And, of course, every time she makes a mistake, they jump on it. You know, nobody talks about the fact that Obama said there were 57 states in the union. And, you know, that was a slip up by him, and I never jumped on that. I just thought it was funny. But, you know, Palin makes a comment she can see Russia from her back porch, and everybody jumps on that. You know, I just think that there's a whole lot going on here, and I think we're going to see Palin stepping up into a bigger role. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you have to think, why does she want to leave the job? And, hey, I mean, all right, yes, you turned around and sort of said Alaska is one of the major states. I'm going to upset some people in Alaska. I probably, you know, because it's not part of the contiguous USA, yeah, I suppose, you know, the governor of Alaska, when I've spoke to other American friends I have, it's maybe not seen as the top job in governorships. But
oil, Martin. Oil.
Well, yeah, I grant you, oil is the real driver, but I still think, you know, I'll probably put some other states ahead of Alaska for being the top ones, but that's purely someone looking in outside. Yes, I have to think that this has been done certainly with consultation and advice from some of the wheelers and dealers and movers inside the Republican Party, who obviously see that maybe in, you know, the next election round for president, you know, Sarah Palin could play a major part. Now, whether they're sort of thinking that she could be the candidate, or whether, you know, she's going to be the person that's going to help drive the Republican Party, you know, or help drive them.
But let me interrupt you here, Martin. That's where I have a problem with her. Okay, and trust me, I've supported Palin. I would have voted for her for a presidential candidate. But here's the problem: she shouldn't have quit. You know, because that's what's going to follow her, I think. And I think that some of the Republicans, like myself, are going to look at her and are going to say, okay, you know, she wants to run the Republican Party. She wants to be the representative for the Republican Party. That's fine. How long is she going to do that before she decides to quit? You know, I'm not real big on supporting a quitter.
And I think that's a very valid point. And I think that's, you know, what people have to think of. But I can't see that she's done this without senior people in the Republican Party being aware of what she's going to do. I just don't see her being that much of a maverick and a live cannon that she's done this off her own bat exclusively. You know, there are people in the Republican Party who are thinking, okay, Sarah Palin wants to go, let's manage this, let's use this. Yeah, and I'm sure some people might turn around and say, you know, she didn't last it, you know, and she could turn around and say, you know, some of the abuse that came at her family. Yeah, I could understand that. But yeah, I just don't see this as just, you know, one governor in one state just making a stand just on her own, that I'm going to give up, I'm going to walk away from this, because there's now no guarantee that, you know, when the governorship comes up for election, you know, how many people are going to think, oh, hang on a minute, the last Republican we had did a runner. Is this going to open the door for a Democrat to get in there? Yeah, is this going to open the door for, you know, someone from the Alaska Independence Party to potentially get into power? So I just don't see this as being Sarah Palin on her own. I see this as part of a very carefully managed and orchestrated campaign to, you know, use Sarah Palin to try and drive the Republican Party forward, so that, you know, whether, okay, yeah, 2012 is your next set of elections.
Right. You could take a stab at that, but I'll tell you, I still think the entire thing revolves around, and look, I could not possibly argue your point. There, you know, there's got to be the larger faction of the Republican Party has got to be not, maybe not controlling her with this move, but at least instigating the move on her part to quit the governorship. But I still think that if she does run for major public office, let's say she runs for president in 2012, how much is this going to hurt her? How many people are going to look at it and go, well, you know, she quit once, you know? What are the odds of quitting again?
I don't see her running in 2012. I've got to think, unless Barack Obama has an absolute nightmare, things go even worse than they are today, I think most people would probably accept in 2.5-3 years' time, hopefully we're going to be, you know, looking back on this recession and sort of turning around and saying, yeah, it was a bit tough, but, you know, economy is probably going to be bouncing, GDPs are going to be growing, inflation's probably going to be, you know, at a plateau, unemployment's going to have dropped. Yeah, it's probably going to be very difficult for the American people to turn around and say, hey, there was a Freudian slip there, taking it back to 1776. And if you want to come back to the Commonwealth America, you only have to ask.
So you guys would take us back if we wanted to come back, Martin. That's all from my side.
Yeah, we would. I'm sure there'd be some terms and conditions, but I could probably sort that out for you. But I just don't see, in reality, if anybody in the Republican Party was to seriously say that we stand today a good chance of winning the 2012 presidential elections, you'd have to look at them and say, wow, can I have whatever you're drinking? I think 2016 is probably an option. And you sort of just think about things, you know. I don't think many people expected George Bush to get re-elected. Either it's going to be an absolute nightmare and Barack Obama is just going to be obvious that he's not going to make it in 2012. But typically, if you ever look at it, the American people typically work in, and just like the UK, you know, we work in two terms. You know, maybe two or three terms tops. You know, people don't necessarily always just go, right, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican. You know, it's normally they say, okay, we've had a few years of the Republican Party, we'll give the Democrats a crack for a couple of terms. Uh-huh. I think if Sarah Palin's clever, she's thinking of 2016. I cannot see that she is thinking of, I'll run for president in 2012.
I have a prediction. I predict Sarah Palin will run for president in 2012, but she will not run on the Republican Party. I predict that Sarah Palin will start a true conservative movement and that she will put herself up as a presidential candidate in 2012 on a hard right-of-center conservative movement.
And guess what? You're just going to open the door to another Democratic presidency.
Absolutely.
You're just going to split that right-of-center vote, because there, some people will go hard-nosed and say, you know, the Christian right will say, fine, well, vote with Sarah Palin.
Right.
You know, those middle ground people who are, you know, thinking, okay, I'm fiscally minded, but I'm not probably, you know, all the dogma that goes with being, you know, fundamental Christian, are going to say, okay, I'll vote GOP. Guess what? Your Democrats are still going to vote Democrat.
Yep. Yeah, and you know what? It's going to be, what's his name all over? The guy from Texas with the big ears. What's his name?
Ooh, you've got me on this one. I was going to say Ross Perot, but I didn't.
That's it. Yeah, Ross Perot. Oh. He's the one that actually put Clinton in office. Ross Perot split the Republican Party, and Clinton got elected the first time.
There you are. So, you know. Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see whether that happens. If it does, guess what? The GOP and this, you know, hardcore right party that Sarah Palin may well become the figurehead of, might as well just look at it and say, guess what? We aren't going to get into power. I would have to say, potentially, you could be looking at years. You could be looking at decades, because if you fragment the Republican vote, the Democratic vote is unlikely to fragment.
Right.
So you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Your liberals are going to stay where they belong, or where they're comfortable within the Democratic Party.
Yeah. So guess what? Republican Party. If you want consultation from Homer and I, you only have to email us. We're not expensive. A few hundred thousand dollars a day. I think that's a fair rate for you, for our intelligence.
Yep. Now, I want to talk about camping. I want to talk about camping at the Honduras border.
See, that's not probably the place that one thinks of. You know, we're in holiday season and everyone's thinking, oh, right, Honduran border. Yes, I think what we're talking about is the president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya.
Ousted president.
So there is a question of whether he is technically the president, yes or no. You know, and you know, we could have a semantics discussion about that one. But yes, there was some kind of military coup that convinced him to leave after he won an election in 2005. And guess what? He's been trying to come back to Honduras, but has been blocked on many occasions. I think even his plane flew into the city in the is it Honduras? I can't remember. Is the capital of Honduras Honduras?
I'm not really sure, but I do know that last Friday he crossed the border, but he ran back over really quick because they came to arrest him.
So you have to sort of think what's going on here. But, you know, this is an example of, you know, I mean, we've spoken a lot about democracy in countries around the world that are, you know, struggling with democracy, you know, or countries that have taken democracy. You know, we spoke about, you know, Pakistan, we've spoken about South Africa. You know, here is a country that, you know, elected a man fair and square. You know, yes, you could argue that maybe there was a little bit of fixing, and you know, I think we've accepted that in some parts of the world that goes on. But you know, he won the Honduran presidential election,
yep.
And now, you know, he's moved things around. Now, one of the interesting things that I see is that, you know, he probably started on a ticket. Well, I know he started on a ticket that was sort of, you know, I'm not going to, you know, antagonize the U.S. You know, and Honduras has typically been seen as a, you know, a U.S. ally. But, you know, guess what? There's, you know, changes in the world, and, you know, Honduras has probably moved towards the left and is much more in tune with what, you know, Venezuela wants with Hugo Chavez. And I'm just wondering whether the military were, how should we say, given some encouragement by, you know, elements of the U.S. intelligence services, maybe the CIA started chucking money around to say, we're not entirely comfortable with this man. Here's some money. We'll give you some backing. You know, so long as you don't overstep the line too much, we're not going to do anything. Guess what? Our president will probably turn around and say, look, not happy about this, democracy and all that, but, you know, he's probably not going to do anything to enforce it. It's just going to be words and something we have to say.
Yeah, and, you know, it does kind of beg the thing, because he was ousted on the 28th of June. With the military coup, and but now the military is saying they would not oppose him coming back to power as long as there were limitations placed upon his leadership. I guess there was some kind of an indication that this was going to be like the situation in Russia, where he was trying to stay in power indefinitely, and even kind of, I guess, the same thing in Iran with Ahmadinejad. But, you know, my thing here is there's nothing in the Honduran the Constitution that allows for term limits, and as long as he's democratically elected, and he was, then I don't see the problem here. But then again, I'm also not in Honduras, and you know, I'm not exactly sure of how their laws work, but I do know that he was elected, and you know, now I'm thinking what the Obama administration is saying, what the coup was not correct, or was it correct, or what's the Obama administration saying, Martin?
Do you know? They're saying it's not legal, but I think you have to, and I suppose you can turn around and say, probably Obama can actually say that. You know, I think if it was a Republican president saying it wasn't legal, I suspect we could sort of think of, you know, Pot, Kettle, and Black would spring to mind. But Barack Obama can say that because he can turn around and say, you know, I'm trying to get out of some things that we've done in the past. You're right. You know, I think you probably still have to turn around and say that Manuel Zelaya is probably still the president of Honduras. The acting president was sworn in by the military. I'm not entirely sure whether the military have the power to do that, but I suppose, you know, if you control the country and you've got potentially all the guns, it probably does give you a lot of power. But one of the things I know that Zelaya was trying to do was a constitutional referendum, which, you know, which he had said, I want to happen, but that was declared unlawful. So, you know, he was, you know, clearly the military decided that they didn't like this. Okay, you know, typically.
Now, here's an interesting thing. Apparently, just prior to the ousting, Zelaya attempted to hold a, and I'm quoting from, looks like the BBC News website, he attempted to hold a non-binding public consultation to ask the people of Honduras whether they supported moves to change the constitution. His opponents said that could have paved the way for his possible re-election. Well, you know, as long as he's going to the people, one, I don't see a problem with that, but I guess they're supposed to have a meeting with the interim president, the interim Honduran leader, and the ousted president are supposed to be meeting, hold on a second, I'm trying to see, in Costa Rica, I believe, here in just a few days. And, of course, Hillary Clinton's getting involved, of course, being, you know, the Secretary of State here. And
you have to think that the US are always going to be interested here, Homer, because it's in their backyard, so to speak. And I know you think of what the US had done in the 70s and the 80s, you know, to ensure, you know, the march of communism was stopped fairly firmly. And I think and you've got to think that there's still obviously got to be some legacy of that in place, that, you know, the last thing they want is, you know, very left-wing governments in their backyard. So I can see, you know, potentially why the US wants to get involved and needs to get involved in this.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a very small country. I mean, like you say, it is in our backyard, and that entire area has been fraught with trouble over the last few decades. Not to dismiss it, you know, the drug trade and you know, a lot of the things that, you know, how much money the United States sink into that entire area in a fight with, you know, against the drug trade. And so, you know, I don't think that these sort of moves are particularly surprising for that area.
No, but, you know, it's something that the US have typically always got involved in, you know, looking after their backyard. So, you know, I really can't fault them for, you know, what they're actually doing there. So let's move away from the American continent, and we've just had a by-election in the United Kingdom in a Norwich North, and unfortunately the ruling party, the Labour government, got another kicking, and the Conservatives have managed to overturn a 5,000 vote majority into a 7,000 vote Tory majority, which means sort of a shift of over 13,000 votes, which I think is just adds up the pressure on our current Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who is just being whacked about the head continually with people in his own party, but then also the voters at every opportunity giving him a bit of a drubbing.
So what does this mean for your overstressed Prime Minister?
Well, I keep on thinking it means that he must, I just cannot see that the Labour Party will keep him as leader.
Yeah, but they've been saying that for how long now, Mark?
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, I think they gave him, you know, a year and a bit to sort of get into the job, but I think there's now I think there's more confidence, or some of the those people who aren't a big fan of his appointment as leader following Tony Blair, I think there's probably more of a groundswell for them to maybe try and go after him. And I can suspect that we will have what we call as the political party conference season in September, which is when all the political parties, you know, get together and sort of talk about where they are, what they're planning to do. Typically, it's been seen as an opportunity, particularly in the Labour Party, to have a leadership challenge. I suspect he may get away with it this time round, because I think the party will manage it. But, you know, I think if you're, you know, in, you know, if you're a Labour supporter or part of the Labour Party, I think you've got to be pretty naive to think that you stand a significant chance of being elected next year. We have to have general elections sometime in, I think it's up until something like July 2010, there must be a general election called. I just cannot see that Gordon Brown is going to be elected as Prime Minister.
Right.
I just can't see the Labour Party doing that. And the Tories, you know, clearly are capitalising on sort of the failures of the government, and they've got a lot of things to smack them down with. They've been in power for a very long time.
Exactly.
You know, Gordon Brown, despite the fact that we don't elect our Prime Minister, has never been to the people as the Prime Minister. And there's a lot of people who sort of say that's just wrong. Guess what? That's the way our system works. In the States, you know, you have a separate executive and you have a separate legislature. So you have, you know, the president, and then you have, you know, Congress, which is clearly separate. In the UK, we just vote for MPs, and the typically the leader of the party with the most seats is the Prime Minister. Fine.
Now, you're saying typically, but is that written down as
Not sure if it's actually written down, but I'm trying to think of an example. Certainly in the last century, I mean, the only time that might not have happened might have been during the Second World War, when we had a government of national unity. But typically, the party that has the biggest number of seats in the House of Commons, its leader is the Prime Minister. It's just tradition. I don't think it's actually
common
sense. Because that is the person that the Queen, and the Prime Minister is asked to form a government by the Queen. So the Queen and her advisers will look through after a general election and say, okay, well, which party has most seats? And if it's, you know, an obvious, you know, one's got 200 seats more than the other, the Queen will always ask the leader of that party to form a government. And typically that person has enough seats to do that.
Right.
So, but it's just interesting how, you know, poor Gordon Brown, it just goes from bad to worst. You know, I mean, even more sad is that the Labour Party candidate for Norwich North got taken out of the elections just before the end by swine flu, which, you know, you just have to think, you know, when things are going wrong, things are just going wrong for you.
Yeah. Martin, it looks like we're getting very close to time.
Well, yeah. Well, the only other thing I wanted to pick up, and I know, you know, you've mentioned, you know, that you've served your country in the past. One of the other things that's hassling Gordon Brown is support for our troops, and particularly equipment. And we've had the Chief of the General Staff, Sir Richard Dannett, who's about to retire, has been rather outspoken about the commitment from the British government to support the troops, particularly with helicopters and transport helicopters. And I just think it's, you know, it's interesting that people are now getting up in arms about this one, saying, you know, all right, if our troops are fighting, let's go and give them that support. You know, and you know, I just think it's going to be, it's more bad news for him. You know, we've had, you know, certainly from a British perspective, this has been a pretty torrid month for deaths in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
I don't know how bad it's been in the States, whether you've had, you know, a similar, you know, I'm trying to think similar, but, you know, whether you've had a large number of deaths from soldiers fighting in Afghanistan.
Not that I've heard, Martin. I've been kind of away from the news for a couple of days. As you know, we've talked offline as far as what I was doing work-wise, but I haven't heard anything that's been any earth-shaking.
Yeah, whereas we've had, I think it's either 18 or 20 British soldiers have died in the month of July. You know,
whoa.
You know, that probably is a product of the fact that, you know, of the coalition in Afghanistan. You know, the two major parties are the Americans and the British. That's not to say that other parts of NATO are helping us out, but if you were to look around the world and you're a commander and you're thinking, right, we have to do a counterinsurgency operation, you know, who are you going to ask to do it? You're either going to ask the Americans to do it, or you're going to ask the British to do it.
Right.
I just suspect at the moment that, you know, we're clearly, you know, nose to nose with, you know, the Taliban and Al Qaeda. You know, and we have a lot of experience in doing that in Northern Ireland and Iraq, and, you know, even going back in the last century throughout the world. You know, we are just taking absolute hammering. But I think it does a prime minister no good when, you know, the most senior military official turns around and says, guess what, I don't think we've got enough equipment. And then you even get a minister saying that, when who then retracts it. You know, it would just be like the US military turning around, you know, the, you know, chief of the defense staff, or, you know, chief of the general staff in the States by turning around live and saying, guess what, to the American people on, I don't know, oh golly, a prime time political show, to turn around and say, guess what, we haven't got enough equipment. I think there would be absolute uproar in the States if a military Absolutely. Commander said that.
Absolutely.
So yeah, so it's just to say, you know, when to coin the phrase here, Homer, when it rains for Gordon Brown, it pours, and I suspect it's probably going to carry on pouring. And I think by the end of this year, he won't be leader of the Labour Party. I'm going to sort of, you know, I'll go out on a limb on that one a little bit. He'll be gone by the end of 2009, and the Labour Party will desperately try and find someone to, you know, lead them into the next general election, knowing full well that if they lose, they can turn around and say, it's not my fault.
Yeah, and you know what? I have to tend to agree with your prediction. He's been under a lot of pressure, and just about everything that's befallen the British government lately has wound up, you know, being aimed and directed at him and blamed on him. So I wouldn't blame the man if he stepped down anyway.
Oh, he won't step down. He won't step down. He'll go kicking and screaming. He will not do a Sarah Palin and walk away from this one. He'll have to be taken away from this job kicking and screaming. He will not quietly walk away. If he does resign, it'll be because it's so obvious and he's been told by some of his closest advisors, either you go or it's going to be messy.
Right. Well, Martin, with that, again, like I said, we are running out of time and we're going to have to go.
Yes, we are. Otherwise, management will be jumping up and down on our heads, and we are still working with management to how do we promote the show, and there's some ideas that we're working on, and we do have some interviews that we are lining up, but we're just working with management to get everything in place. They've told us they're very committed to the show, which is good news for Homer and I. So we're just probably holding back on a couple of juicy things that we can deliver to you so that we can bring it all in a nice relaunched branding of the Above Politics show.
Absolutely. And you know what? I want to thank all our listeners, and I want to encourage, and guys and gals that are listening to us here, that the more feedback that we get from the show, the better we're going to be. And so please, you know, if you have a thought, if you have a comment, if you have a criticism, if you have a correction, please, please throw it into the thread where we post this, and let us know how you feel, what you're thinking, or even if we said something wrong or did something wrong, you know, let us know, and we'll all be better off for it.
Exactly. The corrections bit, I'm going to be used to it. I've been used to being corrected on this show because sometimes I do say very stupid things, so not to worry about that one. So I want to thank you for listening to the Above Politics show.
I'm Homer Fye.
And I'm Martin Bain, and we'll see you next time on the Above Politics show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.